From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we present a series of readings in response to September 11th. We'll hear highlights of Beyond Words, New Yorker writers read the work of others, recorded last night at the Town Hall in Manhattan. It was a benefit for the September 11th Fund presented by the New Yorker magazine. We'll hear from writers Woody Allen, Mary Carr, Walter Mosley, Simon Schama, Donald Antrim, Amitav Ghosh, and Paul Muldoon. Beyond Words, coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Frank Stachow. Authorities said today an assistant to NBC anchorman Tom Brokaw contracted a form of anthrax after opening an envelope containing a suspicious powder. The employee is said to be taking antibiotics and is expected to recover. A few blocks away, two floors of the New York Times building were cleared after a reporter who co-wrote a recent bestseller on bioterrorism opened a letter containing a powdery substance. That substance is being tested to see if it contains anthrax spores. The FBI is investigating both incidents. Barry Maughan heads the FBI office in New York.
Both letters, the one to NBC as well as the one to the New York Times, was postmarked from St. Petersburg, Florida. One was dated 9/20, and the other one was dated 10/5.
Federal authorities investigating the anthrax case in South Florida say there is no evidence that the strains discovered there have been genetically modified. NPR's Philip Davis is in Boca Raton.
Douglas Beecher, an FBI microbiologist, said it would take months to determine with 100% accuracy whether or not the anthrax spores found in the offices of American Media Incorporated in Boca Raton were genetically modified. But Beecher said all the signs point to the anthrax spores being naturally occurring strains.
This organism shows no indication that there's been any genetic modification. It's completely susceptible to all of the antibiotics that the naturally occurring organism is susceptible to.
One American Media employee has died from anthrax infection, but two other employees who have been exposed to the bacteria are apparently successfully fighting it with Cipro, an easily available antibiotic. Almost 1,000 other employees and visitors have been tested for anthrax, and no new cases have been reported. Philip Davis, NPR News, Boca Raton, Florida.
There was a break in military action over Afghanistan Friday. Pentagon officials held off on airstrikes so that Muslims there could attend Friday prayers at their mosques. From the Pentagon, NPR's Tom Gelton reports.
Military operations in Afghanistan are continuing. U.S. pilots flying over the country have permission to bomb what are called targets of opportunity. But no strikes were planned ahead of time Friday. Meanwhile, signs of a shift in the airstrike plan. U.S. planes initially targeted the Afghan air defense system, but Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld says U.S. pilots are now going after people, terrorist leaders, for example.
The United States is seeking out concentrations of people who are involved in these terrorist activities and in the terrorist training camps and in the terrorist network. And when we find them, we do try to deal with them.
The Afghan government is claiming that dozens of civilians have been killed in the airstrikes. The Pentagon does not exclude that possibility, but insists it's focused only on military targets.
NPR's Tom Gelton. It is now Saturday in Afghanistan, and the bombing has resumed. This is NPR News. The House today approved new policy powers, new police powers, sought by the Bush administration to track suspected terrorists. But lawmakers put a 5-year expiration date on the most controversial of them. The 337-79 vote sent the bill back to the Senate. Last night, the Senate passed a version of the bill without the expiration on wiretapping authority. The Senate version also included new tools to combat money laundering. In Northern Ireland, the British government has declared ceasefires of two Protestant paramilitary groups over recent violence. The announcement is a huge blow for the shaky peace process. Marianne Maguire reports from Belfast.
The British Secretary of State for Northern Ireland says recent violence leaves him with no choice. John Reid has declared the ceasefires of the two main Protestant paramilitary groups over. He went on to blame the Ulster Defence Association and the Loyalist Volunteer Force for a surge in sectarian violence and said Britain no longer recognised the truces they had called. It is a further blow to the peace process, already stricken by disagreements between pro-British and Irish politicians over paramilitary disarmament. But political analysts also say that the end of the truces might mean that the Protestant paramilitary groups will launch a full-scale campaign of attacks against Catholics. For NPR News, I'm Marianne Maguire in Belfast.
The Palestinian Authority today cracked down on unrest against the bombing of Afghanistan. Palestinian police briefly detained three foreign reporters covering a rally in the Gaza Strip in support of Saudi-born dissident Osama bin Laden. Palestinian officials said today the U.S. and Britain would soon begin a new initiative to end more than a year of Israeli-Palestinian fighting. I'm Frank Stachow.
Support for NPR comes from MassMutual Financial Group, a global diversified financial services organization with more than $220 billion in assets under management, on the web at massmutual.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Today we bring you an extraordinary set of readings in response to September 11th. Last night, at the Town Hall in Manhattan, The New Yorker magazine presented a program called Beyond Words, New Yorker Writers Read the Work of Others. It was a benefit for the September 11th Fund. Fresh Air recorded the event, and on today's program we'll hear from Woody Allen, Mary Carr, Walter Mosley, Donald Antrim, Amitav Ghosh, Paul Muldoon, and Simon Sharma. The event was introduced by the editor of The New Yorker.
Good evening. I'm David Remnick from The New Yorker magazine. In the aftermath of September 11th, countless New Yorkers have tried to fight through the unspeakable sense of loss and fury by doing something, anything. All over the city, there have been efforts of all kinds, and this is ours. What happened a month ago is beyond words. Words will not raise the dead, but they are part of what embolden us, helps us live in order and order our thinking and deepen the heart. More immediately, we hope tonight we'll do something practical, some practical good. All proceeds raised from this event will be donated to the September 11th Fund, which has been set up to help the victims and their families after the terrorist attacks and is administered by the United Way and the New York Community Trust. Condé Nast and the Newhouse family have agreed to match those funds. Above all, I would like to thank you for coming tonight, and to those who listen on NPR or see this event on television, I hope that you too will do what you can for the September 11th Fund. Thank you.
David Remnick, editor of The New Yorker. Here's Woody Allen. First, he'll read works by Damon Runyon and Damon Runyon Jr.
My dear son, these are your instructions for the disposal of my remains, and you are not to permit anyone to dissuade you from them on any grounds. Have Campbell's, take charge of body immediately on being advised of my death. No funeral services, no display of my body, no flowers. I desire that my body be cremated and any ashes scattered without publicity over the island of Manhattan, the place I have truly loved and that was so good to me. I think you can get Captain Eddie Rickenbacker of Eastern Airways to get his boys to perform this service for me. If you like, you may have my name added to the stone over your mother's grave in the family plot at Woodlawn. I have often expressed these wishes about my disposition, so there is nothing new about them, save as addressed to you personally, in affection, Dad. P.S., there is a copy of these instructions in my box and at the vault in the Chase Manhattan Bank at 57th Street. My father's expressed hope was that he would be in a happy state if he woke up dead and found himself at a big poker game with his departed pals, Tad Dorgan, Sid Mercer, Matty Matthewson, Hype Igo, and all the rest. He hoped, my father said, that they would have held a seat open for him. December 18, 1946, my wife and I went secretly to Campbell's, where I was handed a bulky package wrapped in brown paper tied with thick twine, carefully prepared to conceal the shape. Inside was a heavy bronze urn containing the ashes of Damon Runyon. At Eastern Airlines headquarters in Rockefeller Center, we met Captain Eddie Rickenbacker. From LaGuardia Airport, we went up in a big twin-engine transport with Chief Pilot John F. Gill at the controls, along with co-pilot Captain Eddie Rickenbacker, both of whom had known my father. Rickenbacker, my wife and I, with the urn on my lap, sat in bucket seats in the rear of the plane. The ship droned north and banked over Woodlawn. Then it bore through the dreary day down the Hudson River and turned at 3,000 feet over the Statue of Liberty. Captain Rickenbacker took the urn and went forward to the co-pilot's seat on the right of the cockpit. I stood right behind, bent over in the little companionway. The plane steadied north over Broadway. Captain Rickenbacker tied the wrapping twine from his wrist to the heavy bronze container as insurance against the slip. At Times Square, I nodded, and Captain Rickenbacker tipped the urn out the cockpit window. Nothing was said aloud. False alarm. The voice talked about the city. It was a radio announcer's voice, and I resented its clean diction and its wheedling salesmanship. The voice of warning spoke to the people of the city as though it were trying to sell them a laxative, a tube of toothpaste, a cake of soap, or a pack of cigarettes. It was a cold voice, aloof and precise, and I knew the announcer had spent a lot of time with vocal teachers. The voice told the people of the city to stay off the streets, to be calm, to remain in their homes until the all clear had sounded. The voice said unidentified planes had been spotted beating toward the city. Those planes, I thought, are coming to bomb my family and my friends, to try and destroy the city I love. We sat there in the barracks waiting to go on guard, and we cursed the planes, and I felt angry and helpless. I love the city beyond all places. I'm not a man for country places. And the choir of the crickets annoys me late at night because I want to hear the roaring ebb and flow of Broadway. I like to hear the L trains in the distance, and even after they tore down the structure, I used to listen for them and feel sad when I couldn't hear their rolling clatter. The noise a brook makes is not for me. I want the music in the Stork Club. I see more beauty in the lights of the city than I do in the stars in the sky. I want to see the dawn in the windows of the Empire State Building. All the hills in the world can't stir me the way the big buildings do. It was a false alarm. The planes never came. But that polite radio announcer's voice pronouncing the warning made me hate the enemies of democracy more than anything else ever will. I'd always thought of war being fought in strange lands, in parched fields, or in faraway mud. I thought of it as something that happened to remote cities where other people lived. Although I've always thought our life and our property were in jeopardy, I never imagined New York under fire. I do now. I think of my family and my friends in the city I love every time I take a rifle in my hands and every time I fix my bayonet. As the warning voice droned in Sam Levinson's radio, I thought of Mr. Durkin, who lived in our house on Hudson Street when I was a child. He was a bricklayer, stooped from troweling mortar. I thought of him on a thin ladder in the skeleton of a building. I thought of the ladder buckling and breaking and Mr. Durkin falling. I remembered him coming home mangled and bandaged and how difficult it was to get the stretcher up the narrow stairs. I thought how hard Mr. Durkin worked to build these edifices, which are the symbol of our civilization. I thought of the pride he had in them. I remembered him on a Sunday afternoon taking me by the hand and showing me one, the white strips still crossed on the windows, the dust from the bricks rising in a fog about the foundation. I thought of the sweat and the blood Mr. Durkin had put into these buildings. I thought of the architect's dreams. A single plane coming out of the mists at Sandy Hook could destroy all that Mr. Durkin worked for and had pride in. One bomb might fall, and all the skill and strength, all the living and the dying, all the sweat and the beauty and the dream would vanish, and the winter wind would carry the dust away. I thought of that, and I thought of those who snickered at the likes of me. They mocked the pieces I wrote about the Army. They said I was a sucker because I stayed in when I was over 28 and could have gone out. They were the isolationists, and they said we were a people apart, and we were immune to invasion and fire. What did they say then? What did they think? What was in their minds as the announcer's voice spoke the warning? Did they say these buildings would not fall? These people will not die? This city will not be bombed? Did they say we are the people apart then? I hope they said we are wrong and we admit it. We are a united people now and we must make up for what we did. We were guilty. We will work for forgiveness. In my outfit, most of the guys are from the city. They telephoned their families, and they were angrily glad the warning had been false. But on the field, as we went through a bayonet drill, the non-coms didn't have to drive us. We grunted with pleased exertion as we made the long thrust and the short thrust and the jab. The war had come to the city, and we were part of the city. It's Jimmy Cannon, 1943, by the same author. Nobody asked me, but chorus girls working in their first shows like to wear their stage makeup in the street. Anyone who can drink whiskey out of a paper cup qualifies for Alcoholics Anonymous. Tapping a cigarette on the back of the hand is a habit of incompetent actors. I never heard a funny ventriloquist. A pearl necklace gives most women the quality of piety even when they use eyeshadow. Roasting chestnuts smell better than they taste. What's more out of place than a slave bracelet on a fat man? Chicken pot pie served without crust is stew and should be so described on the menu. Any big city detective will tell you that bookmakers make the most loyal stool pigeons. Candidates who sing hillbilly songs while running for public office should be automatically taken off the ballot. Neat cab drivers are the hostile ones. Did you ever hear anyone bragging about Cincinnati being a good town? It's the only city in the country where the locals are absolutely neutral. Guys who chew on unlit cigars have a tough time convincing me they're telling the truth. Nehru was the only man who didn't look as though he were dressed up for a costume ball when he put on a Nehru jacket. Chances are the lady's miserable if she wears a heart-shaped locket she bought herself. Men with high freckled foreheads favor small knots in their ties. I don't trust guys who make a strong case in an argument and then fold up with, "I guess you're right," if they're challenged. Some of the wisest men I know are bad spellers. I've heard people brag about how they enjoy walking in the rain or in snow, but never mention sleet. The higher the girl's heels, the skinnier her legs figure to be. Anytime someone says, "Can you give me a few minutes of your time?" lay a price, he wants a favor. Belt sizes appear to vary with the manufacturer. Why do people live in Ogden, Utah, if they can make a living someplace else? I can't remember ever having stayed for the end of a movie in which the actors wore togas. Spanish music is the only kind I like played on guitars. Why do performers bother to put on toupees when they call your attention to them with jokes? And finally, a little piece, short piece by John Lardner. New York is a town in which pet cats sit in apartment windows gnashing their teeth at pigeons they can never catch, where there is a colony of gypsies and a colony of Mohawk Indians, where men who have never seen South Bend, Indiana, do snake dances in Leon and Eddie's the night before a Notre Dame football game. Last month, a youth proposed to a girl on the Williamsburg Bridge, and the girl said no. The youth climbed on a girder and threatened to jump. The girl ran to a telephone to call the police. "There's a man trying to jump off the George Washington Bridge," she cried. She had the wrong bridge by 10 miles, but the cops noted the location of the call and went to the right bridge and saved the youth. If they'd gone to the George Washington Bridge, they'd have found love and adventure there, too. It's a wonderful town. Thank you.
Woody Allen recorded last night at the Town Hall in Manhattan in a program called Beyond Words, New Yorker Writers Read the Work of Others. We'll hear more readings after a break. This is Fresh Air. Last night at New York's Town Hall, the New Yorker magazine presented a program called Beyond Words, New Yorker Writers Read the Work of Others. It was a benefit for the September 11th Fund. Today we're presenting highlights of this event. Here's writer Mary Carr.
I struggled with whether or not to read this poem because it's so dark. It's by Paul Celan, who is a Holocaust survivor, and it's a poem about digging for the lost. But it's also about digging into yourself for some sense of history. and it's about one person in great despair digging for someone else, and that moment of resonant clarity when a connection is struck, which is what I think poetry is. It's by Paul Celan, it's translated by Michael Hamburger. There was earth inside them, and they dug. They dug and they dug. So their day went by for them, their night, and they did not praise God, who, so they heard, wanted all this, who, so they heard, knew all this. They dug and heard nothing more. They did not grow wise, invented no song, thought up for themselves no language. They dug. There came a stillness, and there came a storm, and all the oceans came. I dig, you dig, and the worm digs too. And that singing out there says, they dig. O one, O none, O no one, O you, where did the way lead when it led nowhere? O you dig, and I dig towards you, and on the finger the ring awakes. It's a poem by, this is a sort of antidote to the darkness of that poem. It's by Nobel laureate Czesław Miłosz. It's translated by Robert Haas. And it's a poem about how people who don't believe in God can pray. I think it's a great instruction in that. It's called On Prayer. You ask me how to pray to someone who is not. All I know is that prayer constructs a velvet bridge, and walking it, we are aloft as on a springboard, above landscapes the color of ripe gold, transformed by a magic stopping of the sun. That bridge leads to the shore of reversal, where everything is just the opposite, and the word is unveils a meaning we hardly envisioned. Notice, I say we, there, every one separately feels compassion for those entangled in the flesh and knows that if there is no other shore, we will walk that aerial bridge all the same. Thank you.
Writer Mary Carr. Next, we'll hear from writer Walter Mosley.
I'm going to read to you from All Quiet on the Western Front by Eric Maria Remarque. I'm doing this because this is the book that, when I was asked to find something to read, this is the book that had the mood that I feel, not only about us here in New York, but people all over the world for all kinds of reasons. I hope it comes clear from the small passage. Gradually, a few of us are allowed to get up, and I am given crutches to hobble around on, but I don't make much use of them. I can't bear Albert's gaze as I move about the room. His eyes always follow me with such a strange look. So I sometimes escape to the corridor. There, I can move about more freely. On the next floor below are the abdominal and spine cases, head wounds, and double amputations. On the right side of the wing are the jaw wounds, wounds in the joints, wounds in the kidneys, wounds in the testicles, wounds in the intestines. Here a man realizes for the first time in how many places a man can get hit. Two fellows die of tetanus. Their skin turns pale, their limbs stiffen. At last, only their eyes live stubbornly. Many of the wounded have their shattered limbs hanging free in the air from a gallows. Underneath the wound, a basin is placed into which drips the pus. Every 2 or 3 hours, the vessel is emptied. Other men lie in stretching bandages with heavy weights hanging from the end of the bed. I see intestine wounds that are constantly full of excreta. The surgeon's clerk shows me x-ray photographs of completely smashed hip bones, knees, and shoulders. A man cannot realize that above such shattered bodies, there are still human faces in which life goes its daily round. And this is only one hospital, one single station. There are hundreds of thousands in Germany, hundreds of thousands in France, hundreds of thousands in Russia. How senseless is everything that can ever be written, done, or thought when such things are possible? It must all be lies and of no account when the culture of 1,000 years could not prevent this stream of blood being poured out. these torture chambers and their hundreds of thousands. A hospital alone shows what war is. I'm a young man, 20 years old, yet I know nothing of life but despair, death, fear, and fatuous superficiality cast over an abyss of sorrow. I see how peoples are set against one another and in silence, unknowingly, foolishly, obediently, innocently slave one another. I see that the keenest brains of the world invent weapons and words to make it yet more refined and enduring. And all men of my age here and over there, throughout the whole world, see these things. All my generation is experiencing these things with me. What would our fathers do if suddenly we stood up and came before them and proffered our bill? What do they expect of us if a time ever comes when the war is over? Through the years, our business has been killing. It was our first calling in life. Our knowledge of life is limited to death. What will happen afterwards? And what shall come out of us?
Walter Mosley recorded last night at New York's Town Hall in a program called Beyond Words, New Yorker Writers Read the Work of Others. The event was presented by the New Yorker magazine to benefit the September 11th Fund. If you wish to support the September 11th Fund, you can pledge by telephone at 1-800-710-8002 or online at September11Fund.org. We'll hear more of Beyond Words in the second half of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And from Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Beyond Words continues with Simon Sharma reading from the letters of Winston Churchill. We'll also hear readings by Donald Antrim, Amitav Ghosh, and Paul Muldoon. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. On this edition, we're featuring a series of readings in response to September 11th, recorded last night at the Town Hall in Manhattan. The event was called Beyond Words, New Yorker Writers Read the Work of Others. It was presented by the New Yorker magazine to benefit the September 11th Fund. Here's writer Simon Schama.
I'm Simon Schama. You need to know two things about the letters I'm going to read. Winston Churchill, who loved America deeply and passionately, whose mother was American, began 1914 as the First Lord of the Admiralty and ended 1915 as a major in the trenches. From Winston Spencer Churchill to Clementine Churchill, 28th July 1914, midnight, the Admiralty. My darling one and beautiful, everything trends towards catastrophe and collapse. I'm interested, geared up, and happy. Is it not horrible to be built like that? The preparations have a hideous fascination for me. I pray to God to forgive me for such fearful moods of levity. Yet I would do my best for peace, and nothing would induce me wrongfully to strike the blow. I cannot feel that we in this island are in any serious degree responsible for the wave of madness which has swept the mind of Christendom. No one can measure the consequences. I wondered whether those stupid kings and emperors could not assemble together and revivify kingship by saving the nations from hell. But we all drift on in a kind of dull, cataleptic trance, as if it was somebody else's operation. The two black swans on St. James's Park have a darling signet, gray, fluffy, precious, unique. I watched them this evening for some time as a relief from all the plans and schemes. We are putting the whole Navy into fighting trim, and all seems quite sound and thorough. And we are awake to the tips of our fingers, but war is the unknown and the unexpected. God guard us and our long accumulated inheritance. You know how willingly and proudly I would risk or give, if need be, my period of existence to keep this country gay, great and famous and prosperous and free. But the problems are very difficult. One has to try to measure the indefinite and weigh the imponderable. My darling one, ring me up at fixed times, but talk in parables, for they all listen. Kiss those kittens, his children. Kiss those kittens and be loved forever only by me, your own W. 19th of November, 1915. Clementine Spencer Churchill, 41 Cromwell Road. My darling Winston, I long for news of you. I want to know where you are, what your billet is like, whether you're comfortable, what you've had to eat, whether you are happy, my dear one, what you are thinking and feeling. Yesterday I sent after you khaki trousers and shirts, which arrived after you departed. Do you get the newspapers quite easily, or shall I order them for you? Although it's only a few miles, you seem to me as far away as the stars, lost among a million khaki figures. Write to me, Winston. I want a letter from you, badly. Your loving Clemmy. Winston Spencer Churchill to Clementine Spencer Churchill, 23rd of November, 1915, Boudeville, France. My darling, we have finished our first 48 hours in the trenches and are now resting in billets in support. We are near enough to hear rifle fire, but out of range of everything except the artillery, which will not be likely to bother about the cottages and farms where we are living. I've spent the morning on my toilet and a hot bath engineered with some difficulty. When a battalion is in the trenches, we live about 1,000 yards behind in a dugout in rear of a shattered farm. I spent Sunday night in the trenches themselves instead with Griggs's company, and when we go in again tomorrow night, I'm going to stay with them for the whole period. This gives me the opportunity of seeing and learning thoroughly. It's not more dangerous than at battalion headquarters because walks to and from the trenches over an area where stray bullets are skimming are avoided. It is a wild scene. The lines of trenches, or rather breastworks we are now holding, is built along the ruins of other older lines taken from the Germans. The guards are cleaning everything and work night and day to strengthen the parapets and improve the shelter. Filth and rubbish everywhere, graves built into the defenses and scattered about promiscuously, feet and clothing breaking through the soil, water, muck on all sides. And about this scene, in dazzling moonlight, troops of enormous rats creep and glide to the unceasing accompaniment of rifle and machine guns and the venomous whining and whirring of the bullets which pass overhead. Amid these surroundings, aided by wet and cold and every minor discomfort, I found happiness and comfort, such as I have not known. Will you now send regularly, once a week, a small box of food to supplement the rations? Sardines, chocolates, potted meats, and other things which may strike your fancy. Begin as soon as possible. Do you realize what a very important person a major is? 99 people out of 100 in this great army have to touch their hats to me. With this inspiring reflection, let me sign myself, your loving and devoted husband, Winston. Kiss Randolph, Diana, and that golden Sarah for me. Clementine Spencer Churchill to Winston Spencer Churchill. 12th of January, 1916, 41 Cromwell Road. My own darling, I long so to be able to comfort you. Later on, when you are in danger in the trenches, you will be equable and contented, while I, who am now comparatively at ease, will be in mortal anxiety. Try not to brood too much. I'd be so unhappy if your naturally open and unsuspicious nature became embittered. Patience is the only grace you need. If you're not killed, as sure as day follows night, you will come into your own again. I know you don't fear death. It is I who dread that. But I'm almost glad to be suffering because I'm sure no single soul will be allowed to live through this time without sorrow. So perhaps what we are enduring now will be counted, and we shall be spared the greatest pain of all. When it's all over, we'll be proud you're a soldier and not a politician for the greater part of the war. Soldiers and soldiers' wives seem to me now the only real people. I'm glad you tell me all you feel, darling. I want to know it all. I, too, show a detached and smiling face to the world. I wish I had some interesting news for you. Goodbye, my darling. I send you my kisses. Your loving Clemmy. Do you want any more cigars?
Writer Simon Schama recorded last night at New York's Town Hall in a program called Beyond Words, New Yorker Writers Read the Work of Others, to benefit the September 11th Fund. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Last night at New York's Town Hall, the New Yorker magazine presented a program called Beyond Words, New Yorker Writers Read the Work of Others. It was a benefit for the September 11th Fund. On this edition of Fresh Air, we're presenting highlights of the event. Here's writer Donald Antrim.
This is a letter written in 1820 from Sydney Smith to Lady Georgiana Morpeth. Dear Lady Georgiana, nobody has suffered more from low spirits than I have done. So I feel for you. First, live as well as you dare. Second, go into the shower bath with a small quantity of water at a temperature low enough to give you a slight sensation of cold. 75 degrees or 80 degrees. Third, amusing books. Fourth, short views of human life, not further than dinner or tea. Fifth, be as busy as you can. Sixth, see as much as you can of those friends who respect and like you. Seventh, and of those acquaintances who amuse you. Eighth, make no secret of low spirits to your friends, but talk of them freely. There are always worse for dignified concealment. Ninth, attend to the effects tea and coffee produce upon you. Tenth, compare your lot with that of other people. 11th, don't expect too much from human life, a sorry business at the best. 12th, avoid poetry. 13th, dramatic representations, except comedy. Music, serious novels, melancholy, sentimental people, and everything likely to excite feeling or emotion not ending in active benevolence. 13th, do good and endeavor to please everybody of every degree. 14th, be as much as you can in the open air without fatigue. 15th, make the room where you commonly sit gay and pleasant. 16th, struggle by little and little against idleness. 17th, don't be too severe upon yourself or underrate yourself, but do yourself justice. 18th, keep good blazing fires. 19th, be firm and constant in the exercise of rational religion. 20th, believe me, dear Lady Georgiana, very truly yours, Sydney Smith.
I'm Amitav Ghosh, and I'm going to read poems by Agha Shahid Ali. Shahid was born in Kashmir into a Shia Muslim family. Although he moved to the United States as a graduate student, Shahid continued until recently to spend his summers in Kashmir. As a Kashmiri Muslim, Shahid has lived through many years of terrorism and repression. His name means witness, and that is what he has been. 2 years ago, while teaching in New York, Shahid was diagnosed with a malignant brain tumor. The disease is now in a very advanced state, and Shahid is currently living in Amherst. His love of life is undiminished, however, and when I last went up to see him, he told me a story about the rather topical subject of flying while brown. Some years ago, at the airport in Barcelona, Shahid was about to board a plane when he was taken aside by a woman in uniform. At the end of a long interrogation, the woman asked him, "Are you carrying anything that could be dangerous for the other passengers?" Without skipping a beat, Shahid answered, "Oh, just my heart." This first poem is called Farewell. At a certain point, I lost track of you. They make a desolation and call it peace. When you left, even the stones were buried. The defenseless would have no weapons. When the ibex rubs itself against the rocks, who collects its fallen fleece from the slopes? O weaver who seems perfectly vanished, who weighs the hairs on the jeweler's balance, they make a desolation and call it peace. Who is the guardian tonight of the gates of paradise? My memory is again in the way of your history. Army convoys all night like desert caravans. In the smoking oil of dimmed headlights, time dissolved. All winter, it's crushed fennel. We can't ask them, are you done with the world? In the lake, the arms of temples and mosques are locked in each other's reflections. Have you soaked saffron to pour on them when they are found like this, centuries later, in this country, I have stitched to your shadow? In this country, we step out with doors in our arms. Children run out with windows in their arms. You drag it behind you in lit corridors. If the switch is pulled, you will be torn from everything. At a certain point, I lost track of you. You needed me. You needed to perfect me. In your absence, you polished me into the enemy. Your history gets in the way of my memory. I am everything you lost. You can't forgive me. I am everything you lost, your perfect enemy. Your memory gets in the way of my memory. I am being rowed through paradise on a river of hell. Exquisite ghost, it is night. The paddle is a heart, it breaks the porcelain waves. It is still night. The paddle is a lotus. I am rowed as it withers towards the breeze, which is soft as if it had pity on me. If only somehow you could have been mine, what wouldn't have happened in this world? I'm everything you lost, you won't forgive me. My memory keeps getting in the way of your history. There is nothing to forgive, you won't forgive me. I hid my pain even from myself. I revealed my pain only to myself. There is everything to forgive, you can't forgive me. If only somehow you could have been mine, what would not have been possible in the world? Thank you.
Writer Amitav Ghosh recorded last night at New York's Town Hall in an event called Beyond Words, New Yorker Writers Read the Work of Others. It was presented by the New Yorker magazine to benefit the September 11th Fund. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Last night at New York's Town Hall, the New Yorker magazine presented a program called Beyond Words, New Yorker Writers Read the Work of Others. It was a benefit for the September 11th Fund. Today we're presenting highlights of this event. We conclude with writer Paul Muldoon.
This is David Ferry's translation of Horace's Ode from Book 2, it's number 10, to Licinius. You'll do better, Licinius, not to spend your life venturing too far out on the dangerous waters, or else, for fear of storms, staying too close in to the dangerous rocky shoreline. That man does best who chooses the middle way, so he doesn't end up living under a roof that's going to ruin, or in some gorgeous mansion everyone envies. The tallest pine shakes most in a windstorm. The loftiest tower falls down with the loudest crash. The lightning bolt heads straight for the mountaintop. Always expect reversals. Be hopeful in trouble. Be worried when things go well. That's how it is for the man whose heart is ready for anything. It's true that Jupiter brings on the hard winters. It's also true that Jupiter takes them away. If things are bad right now, they won't always be. Apollo isn't always drawing his bow. There are times when he takes up his lyre and plays and awakens the music sleeping upon the strings. Be resolute when things are going against you, but shorten sail when the fair wind blows too strong. This was written by Dorothy Muldoon on the 19th of September of this year, a normal day. Just taking a normal day and transforming it halfway through seems impossible while you're packing your lunch. It seems impossible when you're riding to school. It seems impossible when you're sitting in class. But no one will ever be able to tell how fast an airplane can crash into a building, how fast a building can fall, and how fast 6,000 people can die with one swipe of a wing. As it is, ashes, ashes, we all fall down. This is W.H. Auden's September 1st, 1939. I sit in one of the dives on 52nd Street, uncertain and afraid, as the clever hopes expire of a low, dishonest decade. Waves of anger and fear circulate over the bright and darkened lands of the earth, obsessing our private lives. The unmentionable odor of death offends the September night. Accurate scholarship can unearth the whole offense from Luther until now that has driven a culture mad. Find what occurred at Linz, what huge imago made a psychopathic god. I and the public know what all school children learn. Those to whom evil is done do evil in return. Exiled Thucydides knew all that a speech can say about democracy and what dictators do, the elderly rubbish they talk to an apathetic grave. Analyzed all in his book, The Enlightenment Driven Away, the habit forming pain, mismanagement and grief. We must suffer them all again. Into this neutral air, where blind skyscrapers use their full height to proclaim the strength of collective man, each language pours its vain, competitive excuse. But who can live for long in an euphoric dream? Out of the mirror they stare, imperialism's face, and the international wrong. Faces along the bar cling to their average day. The lights must never go out. The music must always play. All the conventions conspire to make this fort assume the furniture of home. Lest we should see where we are, lost in a haunted wood, children afraid of the night who have never been happy or good. The windiest militant trash important persons shout is not so crude as our wish. What Mad Dzhinsky wrote about Diaghilev is true of the normal heart. For the error bred in the bone of each woman and each man craves what it cannot have, not universal love, but to be loved alone. From the conservative dark into the ethical life, the dense commuters come, repeating their morning vow. I will be true to the wife. I'll concentrate more on my work. And helpless governors wake to resume their compulsory game. Who can release them now? Who can reach the deaf? Who can speak for the dumb? All I have is a voice to undo the folded lie, the romantic lie in the brain of the sensual man in the street and the lie of authority whose buildings grope the sky. There is no such thing as the state, and no one exists alone. Hunger allows no choice to the citizen or the police. We must love one another or die. Defenseless under the night, our world in stupor lies. Yet, dotted everywhere, ironic points of light flash out wherever the just exchange their messages. May I, composed like them, of eros and of dust, beleaguered by the same negation and despair, show an affirming flame.
Writer Paul Muldoon recorded last night at New York's Town Hall in a program called Beyond Words, New Yorker Writers Read the Work of Others. The event was a benefit for the September 11th Fund. If you wish to support the September 11th Fund, you can pledge by telephone at 1-800-710-8002 or online at September11Fund.org. Our thanks to the New Yorker Magazine, Town Hall, and the writers who participated in this event. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our broadcast of Beyond Words was produced by Naomi Person and Megan Howell. Our thanks to engineers Joyce Lieberman and Fred Snyder. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Delacorte Press, a division of Random House, publisher of Chasing the Hawk, Looking for My Father, Finding Myself, a memoir by Andrew Sheehan. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, writer Jonathan Franzen reads from and talks about his new best-selling novel, The Corrections. And our linguist Jeff Nunberg considers the word infidel and the language of religious fundamentalism. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.